Ennally parallels Nietzsche and prefigures the horrors of the so-called Gulag Archipelago, whose machinations were laid bare by Alexander Solzhenitsyn a century later. I drove this point home in my foreword to the 50th anniversary commemorative edition of the latter masterwork. Members of the bourgeoisie, beyond all redemption, they had to go, as a matter of course. What of their wives, children, even their grandchildren? Off with their heads, too. All were incorrigibly corrupted by their class identity, and their destruction therefore ethically necessitated. How convenient that the darkest and direst of all possible motivations could be granted the highest of moral standings. That was a true marriage of hell and of heaven. What values, what philosophical presumptions truly dominated under such circumstances? Was it desire for brotherhood, dignity, and freedom from want? Not in the least, not given the outcome. It was instead, and obviously, the murderous rage of hundreds of thousands of biblical Cains, each looking to torture, destroy, and sacrifice their own private Abels. There is simply no other manner of accounting for the corpses. The same spirit that inspired Nietzsche and Dostoevsky made itself known to Noah when he found himself, despite himself, possessed by the intuition that a calamity of apocalyptic magnitude was pending. Why? Because the spirit of Cain had come to rule the world. 4.3, salvation by the wise and the reestablishment of the world. The most ancient of prophets is described in the following terms. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. Genesis 6:9. Noah, who found favor in the eyes of the Lord, Genesis 6:8, is thus characterized as a man as good as could be expected, given the limitations of his time and place, hence, in his generations. This is as good as it gets, except in the most exceptional of human cases, as we are all, to some degree, creatures of the specific environment we find ourselves thrown into. To walk with God is to inhabit that Edenic space characterized by the absence of the self-consciousness that is simultaneously presumptuous and neurotic, as Adam, before becoming aware of his nakedness, could do the same. A man aiming at what is highest and concentrating on the truth, instead of focusing on and promoting his own self-centered interest, lacks self-consciousness because what he is attending to is not about him, at least not as an isolated being trapped in the carnal now. He is doing something other than following the instinctual and immediate dictates of his impulsive and narcissistic self-interest. That latter tactic ensures only the emergence of involuntary self-reflection and painful self-consciousness, as we have seen. Am I making the impact I want and need so desperately to make? Am I impressing those whom I am parading myself in front of? Am I winning this argument? Am I emerging as the victor in this contest of status? Am I successfully insisting on my publicly displayed moral virtue? The alternative is to walk unself-consciously with God. Imagine being on stage, a daunting proposition for everyone. You are delivering a talk, concentrating on the take-home message, giving a lecture, or participating in some equally cliched enterprise. In consequence, you are worrying, is my message coming across? Do I sound like I know what I'm talking about? Will the audience find me interesting and impressive? What are people thinking of me? This is all instrumental, self-serving reasoning, and suffering self-consciousness will necessarily and inevitably ensue. You will feel nervous and unsure in precise proportion to the degree that the event is inappropriately about you, about your performance. What is the alternative to such strategizing? On stage, and elsewhere for that matter, it is simple. Strive to address the issue under consideration as honestly and clearly as possible. Then the event is no longer about you, so there is no reason for self-consciousness. It becomes instead, and properly so, about the search for truth in relation to the question at hand. That question, too, must be an honest one, one you truly regard as of crucial import. Why otherwise waste your time and the time of those in the audience? The same logic can and should be applied to every situation in life. Why should it be? There is no superior approach. How could there be an approach equal to confronting what is actually there? If the presentation is about illuminating the topic of utmost current interest and bringing clarity to the matter, instead of devoted to you and your concerns, the reasons for self-consciousness vanish, not least because that self is no longer in the picture. What could be there instead, guiding your conduct, is the spirit of honest explanation and the attempt to reveal and generate the order that is good. Genesis 1. What could be there is the attempt to clarify and explicate in the service of what is highest, and for no other reason. This means to speak in a manner that abides by the truth, and to say what calls out and plagues conscience or calls to be said, not for the sake of reputation, but because the stark reality of the situation can best be expressed in that manner. This means to publicly wayfind. And is that not the task of the genuine leader? To sacrifice the merely instrumental and narrowly self-serving, and to replace it with what is truly higher, while maintaining faith that truthful revelation will produce the order that is good, or even very good, regardless of all evidence to the contrary. That is the mysterious secret to genuine confidence on stage, and more generally in life. All the world's a stage, as Shakespeare said, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. Everything else is the shallow and ultimately pointless, deceptive, manipulative, impulsive, and self-defeating mimicry of the narcissist. The immediate consequence of failure to lie may well be suffering, or, equally, failure to gain an advantage that is not, in fact, deserved. Indeed, avoidance of short-term pain and inappropriate movement forward are the two greatest reasons to lie. Do lies work in this regard? Sometimes, and for a time. Otherwise, the motivation to deceive would not exist. That evidence is no final proof, however, of the superiority of the lie to the truth. The twin issues of time frame and cross-situational validity inevitably raise their hydra-like heads. Over the medium to long term, with regard to the stability and sustainability of psyche and community alike, nothing suffices but the truth, all things considered, as they must optimally be. Faith in the truth that establishes, regenerates, and redeems is voluntary acceptance or recognition of that fact, allied with the decision to live in keeping with that conclusion. The realization of that necessity is what is portrayed as the descent of the baptismal dove that serves as the initiation to the kingdom of heaven, Matthew 3:16-17, or as receipt of the paraclete or comforter or guide that Christ promises to leave with his disciples after his departure, John 14:26. That faith in the truth is the alliance between man and the Word that creates at the beginning of time and for eternity the veritable reflection of the image of God in which man and woman are made, as outlined in Genesis 1. In the story of Noah and the flood, the entire weight of the world's renewal comes to rest on the shoulders of one man, one properly behaving descendant of Seth, Abel's fraternal substitute or replacement, one truly good man. This is a matter of no small psychological import, because this is always the situation, existentially speaking. As Solzhenitsyn points out, and this, I submit, is the most important thing in life, to live and to create out of one's own truth, or one's own chaos, as the case may be, even if it is only a single word or a single vision. For we are, each of us, inevitably heroes of our own lives. And if we are not, then we have missed the whole point of our existence. This is a truth constantly echoed in the biblical corpus. Each prophet, Moses, Elijah, and Jeremiah, perhaps foremost among them, is typically a lone voice crying in the wilderness, Mark 1:1-4. Likewise, when God determines to destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, dwelling places lost, like the whole world of Noah's peers in wickedness and sin, Abraham gets him to agree to spare the force of his destruction if, first, 50, but eventually, as a consequence of continual bargaining, only 10 righteous men can be discovered in those places of habitation. What is the idea being put forth here? That truth is such a potent force that even the tyranny of the overwhelming majority cannot prevail against it. And how could it prevail unless reality itself did not exist and everything was reducible to human presumption and whim? A whole polity set against the spirit of being and becoming itself is still wrong, and wrong in a manner that the consensus multiplies and deepens rather than alleviates. There is no more wrong than when everyone agrees to be wrong. That is the very definition of a totalitarian state, which are not so much top-down tyrannies as collective agreements to abide by nothing but the lie. A society that retains enough of the proper covenant so that a few, or even one, still dare speak freely within its confines can be protected from utter cataclysm by that faith and courage. This is part of the reason why protection of free speech is not so much a right, and certainly not one granted benevolently by the state, but the pillar upon which a stable and yet dynamically adaptive society is predicated and founded. The right is there only so that the responsibility can be shouldered, the responsibility to speak in a manner that reflects the spirit of the cosmic order. This is the properly ordered free speech that establishes, renews, and redeems both individual and state. The state can never, therefore, find itself in a position where it can rightfully dispense with or deny the right to free speech, as it depended on that right for its very establishment, and still relies on it for criticism, correction, and resurrection. This is yet another terrible truth, indicating, as it does, that the salvation of the world itself depends in some impossible and mysterious fashion on the determination of each sovereign individual, touched by the spirit of divine worth, to dwell within the garden of the truth, and to allow the voice and the will of the God he walks with in that garden to guide his attention, action, and utterance. As Dostoevsky has it in The Brothers Karamazov, Every one of us is undoubtedly responsible for all men and everything on earth, not merely through the general sinfulness of creation, but each one personally for all mankind and every individual man. He continues this train of thought later in the novel. There is only one means of salvation. Then take yourself and make yourself responsible for all men's sins. That is the truth, you know, friends, for as soon as you sincerely make yourself responsible for everything and for all men, you will see at once that it is really so and that you are to blame for everyone and for all things. What could this utterly preposterous, but nonetheless stellar or profound and fundamental claim possibly mean? It sounds, on first encounter, like nothing so much as a kind of manic insanity. Is it not clearly the case, however, that each of us serves as an example to ourselves as much as to others, and that we can do some good in this regard, making the world a less evil place than it might otherwise be? And is it not true that we do not and cannot know the upper limit to this influence? If you were a better person, even perhaps the best person you could possibly be, the person who has pulled out all the stops in his adventurous sojourning forward, how much better would everyone else be in direct consequence? And if such an effect is truly possible, is it not equally true in some mysterious manner that the sins of the world are the result of your own inadequacy, your own failure to bear sufficient responsibility? And is this also not a logical and necessary corollary of your making in the image of God and your supposedly self-evident status as a center of the cosmos itself? And is this not the very reason that in our free Western societies, the individual is set apart even from the social and the consensual as a figure of infinite implicit worth? And if the integrity of psyche and community depend on that setting apart, how can it be judged as other than true? Your failure to bring everything you can to bear on the matters at hand leaves a hole in the structure of being itself. That might well be the true impediment to the establishment of the kingdom of God on earth. Woe truly and inevitably be to him by whom this sin mars the world. It is exactly such responsibility that is accepted by Noah. He encounters God in a manner that differs from that of Adam and Eve, who experience him as creative force and maker of boundaries, or of Cain and Abel, who encounter him as ideal and judge. God's manifestation to the first prophet is, however, still a reflection of the same underlying unity, hence monotheism. It is the same singular spirit making itself manifest, however varied in its characterization. Or so is the insistence of the text, which juxtaposes and sequences its various stories precisely to make that point. God is for the captain designate of the ark, the intuition of the wise, that the storm is gathering, the realization that the time has come to batten down the hatches and to make the house shipshape. Modern people are obsessed with the idea of believing in God, as if that decision is one of positing or refusing to posit some material existence or absence thereof, or some mere description, like the description of an object. God exists, according to the implicit dictates of such a formulation, in the same manner that a table exists, or in the manner that an imaginary table truly does not exist. This conceptualization of belief typifies, in the modern world, both so-called believers, or people of faith, and agnostics and atheists alike. Such is the depth of our current state of ignorance. To believe is much more truly and usefully to commit to sacrifice everything to be voluntarily possessed by. True belief is therefore the ultimate relationship, not the mere description of some state of affairs. Imagine Noah's situation, whatever the metaphysics of God's ultimate reality might be. Consider the choices that confront him, the nature of the possibility that shines forth for him. He can either assume the accuracy of his intuition, assume that he is wrong in his suspicions, or waver in a confused manner between those two presumptions. Those choices constitute his entire range of options. This is a state of affairs that has little to do, once again, with the existence of God as material fact. It might be objected. There are additional choices that such an analysis does not take into consideration. Noah could, for example, turn his attention to an endless potential variety of other concerns. Turning away, however, is not a true alternative choice. It is instead the most serpentine and Machiavellian form of avoidance of conscience, a form of missing the proper mark by hypocritical substitution. This is lying by omission rather than commission, the all too easily rationalizable lie of avoidance, the most subtle form of deception, self and otherwise. Hiding from necessity, even by doing some other hypothetically right thing, does not make the necessity any less real. It just obscures the way forward, confuses, kills hope, and divides. Noah therefore has what are in essence two choices, to prepare or to ignore by one means or another the concerns that now plague and preoccupy him, to attend to his true duty or to ignore the prime dictate of the still small voice which we explored when it spoke most famously to Elijah, Kings 19:12. Noah's faith, therefore, is not the explicit statement of his belief in an imaginary being, as the follower or formulator of creeds might have it, but his identity with a certain spirit of conceptualization, apprehension, and forward movement. Does God exist for Noah? Does Noah believe? Here is the situation, properly construed. God is for Noah by definition what guides him, what seizes him as he makes his way forward, no matter what he decides to do. All his choices must therefore be properly construed as decisions and acts of faith, because he does not and cannot truly know what is coming. Why conceptualize this specifically as faith in God? Because Noah must elevate something to the highest place, something that therefore is functionally equivalent to God, so that every other choice has been sacrificed and foregone. That which now guides, established as fundamental or superordinate, and movement forward made possible. The fact that this uniting spirit is God would remain true, even if Noah explicitly disavowed any so-called religious belief. Belief in something beyond what is known is a prerequisite for attention and action on behalf of any creature who, like man, is and must remain fundamentally ignorant. This is true for every man and woman who has ever existed, exists now, and will ever exist. Noah's belief in God is therefore not the formulaic recitation of an explicit proclamation of belief, although it could be also that, but his willingness to act when called on by the deepest inclinations of his soul. What you allow to move you, that is your belief in God or in some second-rate substitute. This is a matter of definition, not least within the story we are considering. The same applies, in general, to all the stories currently under consideration. Noah is a wise man, seized by the intuition of an impending flood. He determines to move forward in accordance with that revelation, regardless of difficulty or opposition. It is God, and once again, by definition, who is the ultimate source, foundation, or aim of that conviction. That is the very point of the text. The story of Noah, like all the ancient stories we will consider, is thus not an argument for the existence of God rendered against the doubt of believer and unbeliever alike, but a description of what is to be held properly in the very highest of places, so that the continuation of man, society, and world may be ensured. How does Noah justify his belief? How, more precisely, does he find the courage of his convictions? It is not for nothing that he is described as wise. A wise man is someone who has consistently paid attention, informed himself and others as a consequence, told himself and others the truth insofar as he was capable, and acted in accordance with that truth. A wise man has been continually aiming up and abiding by the truth. His hierarchy of value is therefore uncorrupted by lies, and his vision, consequently, untrammeled. His capacity to receive a beneficial and accurate revelation was thereby honed, practiced, developed, and perfected, as was his ability to differentiate between a true or deep revelation, let us say, and the mere temptations of momentary hedonic whim. That might be regarded as the capacity of the wise for sagacious deliberation. Noah has practiced orienting his eyes heavenward, practiced identifying the waymarkers that led uphill. He has learned how to place himself in a position to receive the revelation that is reliable and to then follow its dictates. He has removed the beam from his eye, opened his ears to hear, knocked on the door so that it will open, and sought so that he could find. Noah has refused to tell himself the lies that tempt with the pleasures of short-term gratification and avoidance of ultimate responsibility. Thus, he can see what is right in front of his eyes and can and will note before anyone else the gathering clouds. He therefore has faith in himself and what is highest and can and will act accordingly. This is his relationship, his covenant with God. By definition, this means that he has the same relationship to himself and to the cosmic order as someone might have with another person they admire greatly and whose advice they would rely on in times of trouble. Such people are those whom observation and reputation have deemed sagacious, careful, capable of delay of gratification, other-oriented in the proper manner, and mature. Questions of faith. When you believe the storm is approaching, do you batten down the hatches and prepare or not? Do you hearken to your intuition or not? Do you trust yourself or not? And if you do not, is it not because you have become untrustworthy to yourself in the same way that another person might have revealed himself as untrustworthy to you? If you do not trust yourself, is it not because, as in the case of that unreliable other, you have continually lied to yourself and obscured your own vision? Have you not thereby undermined the ground on which you could have otherwise stood? Is the ability to accurately intuit and to react appropriately wisdom or not? Perhaps you have conducted yourself in a manner that enables you to rely on your deepest intuitions. then you are following the spirit of that intuition. You are acting out that spirit or inviting it to possess you. You are celebrating or even worshiping that spirit, sacrificing to that spirit, as everything else is rendered secondary or even non-existent, manifesting faith in that spirit, believing in that spirit. If you reject the call or the demand of conscience when it reveals itself, say, as a warning to prepare, or even if you offer a half-hearted yes, then you are instead denying that spirit and manifesting faith in something else. There is simply no non-faith predicated path forward. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man, whom I have created, from the face of the earth, both man and beast, and the creeping thing, and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Genesis 6:1-8. The degeneration spoken of in these verses, a result of the sin of Cain and its spread, is something that can and does realize itself everywhere when it emerges. Something that occurs at the micro and macro level simultaneously. Something that makes up the motivation for every personal glance and expression, and the aim of every executive, legislative, and judicial decision. This is the multi-headed hydra of the degenerate patriarchal state, or the rise of the terrible dragon mother of chaos that is the inevitable alternative to individual integrity, sustainable voluntary social structure, harmony with the cosmic order, and fealty to God. The proclivity to sin, or the wickedness of man, is the true root cause of the chaos that envelops us in our personal lives first, when we let things fall apart around us in our personal lives, and then on the familial, community, state, or global stage, when the web of lies so generated becomes sufficiently broad. It is not often that any of us experience a truly apocalyptic occurrence, although it is not precisely rare. In the 20th century alone, there were two world wars, the utter and still unresolved catastrophe of fascism and communism, mass-scale economic upheaval and dislocation, the dawn of the atomic and computer ages, and the sexual revolution. But even within the smaller confines of our personal lives, things continually and apocalyptically disintegrate and revert to a chaos of confusion and possibility. A once thriving business becomes corrupt as its founders turn away from the attention and diligent practice necessary to maintain its operations. A marriage collapses for the same reasons. Unmaintained friendships likewise wane or even reverse. All the best laid plans of mice and men can and do go astray, partly because everything tends towards entropic decay of its own accord, and partly because we can speed that process by aiming badly or not at all, as Mircea Eliade so brilliantly and trenchantly observes. The majority of the flood myths seem in some sense to form part of the cosmic rhythm. The old world, peopled by a fallen humanity, is submerged under the waters, and sometime later, a new world emerges from the aquatic chaos. In a large number of variants, the flood is the result of the sins or ritual faults of human beings. Sometimes it results simply from the wish of a divine being to put an end to mankind. The chief causes lie at once in the sins of men and the decrepitude of the world. This pattern of degeneration inevitably makes itself manifest at every level of order, from psyche to nation, even at the level of the hypothetical environment or the natural world, and for the same fundamental reason. Noah therefore faces, albeit on the largest possible scale, as befits a giant of old, what everyone faces all the time in relationship to their own personal plans and schemes, well or poorly conceived and formulated as they may be. How does he manage? He builds the ark, of course, to carry him, his family, and the natural world itself through the catastrophe. Nonetheless, the solution that Noah offers is not, in the final analysis, technological. The first great prophet and post-lapsarian savior has the character that enables him to muster the forces and resources necessary to build the ark, to convince his family of the necessity to do so, and to navigate the secure container he has built through the subsequent terrible storms. This means that his integrity is first and foremost, and his technical ability, something subdued in the appropriate manner and in the appropriate place in the heavenly hierarchy below that. We all do what Noah is called upon to do, with varying degrees of commitment and success throughout our lives. Noah's character and ours is proximally his humility, wisdom, goodness, and productive generosity, and sheltering and encouraging nature, but more distally, the indwelling of the protective and all-seeing Spirit of God, by definition. And it was as true then as it is true now, that such character is at the deepest level of reality, the true reflection of the image of God. It is for such reasons that all truly admirable people are, first, admirable, and second, similar in the fact of their admirability. They all embody something deep, necessary, creative, active, wise, truthful, and loving. This means, in the symbolic language, that they most truly reflect the image of their Creator. Why the prima facie absurd insistence that Noah is responsible not only for the survival of his family and the human race, but for all the animals that inhabit the antediluvian world? Recall for a moment the fact that Adam is called on to serve as steward of the Garden of Eden. This is a description of an inevitability. The cognitive, psychological, or spiritual advantage that human beings have over all other creatures makes it eternally the case that the very existence of other creatures is increasingly dependent on the quality of our moral choices. If we do not shepherd even the wilderness, the environment whose proper stewardship now so thoroughly obsesses us, then its vast resources, whose presence had little or nothing to do with us, become rapidly depleted. We have already eliminated a vast array of animals of approximately our size, who either competed with us for scarce resources, preyed foolishly and ultimately counterproductively upon us, or served too temptingly as a source of food. This has occurred on continent-wide scales and in the oceans, and is by no means a phenomenon limited to the last few hundred years, or something that is merely and modernly a consequence of the tremendous recent expansion of our technological prowess. Human beings made their presence known in the Western Hemisphere a maximum of 20,000 years ago, within a few millennia, the once plentiful major mammals occupying approximately the human niche, mastodons and mammoths, saber-toothed cats, giant ground sloths, the armadillo-like glyptodonts, American lions, and dire wolves had all disappeared. The same thing happened to a variety of marsupials in Australia, although even more distantly in the past, as humans arrived there some 50,000 years ago, and even longer ago, to both giant tortoises and birds, particularly on islands. These brute and sobering facts make a mockery of the idiotic Rousseauian noble savage presumption that less technologically advanced or even specifically non-European people lived in some sort of unchanging and pristine harmony with an equally unchanging and primeval nature. Spears and clubs, particularly when wielded by a cooperative hunting group, are a sufficiently radical advance in technology so that even fierce and adept predators stand little long-term chance against human foes. The situation obtaining on the high seas is, if anything, more dire. Up to 90% of the population of large predatory fish populations in the North Atlantic, including cod, tuna, and swordfish, had already been depleted by the end of the 1800s due to overfishing and other human activities. Since then, 90% of remaining stocks have disappeared. The point? Without ultimately upward-aiming men, there are even no animals. The necessity for the appropriate, properly subdued, moral concern about non-human creatures is therefore highlighted not only in the original command of God to Adam to cultivate, work, tend, watch over, take care of, dress, and keep the garden, Genesis 2:25, various translations, but in the similar injunctions interspersed throughout the Old Testament. Beasts of burden, like human beings, are thus to be granted a Sabbath, Exodus 20:10. The aforementioned oxen who treadeth out the corn are not to be muzzled while doing so, so they can benefit to some degree by their own labor, eating while working, Deuteronomy 25, 4-5, 1 Corinthians 9:9. And the righteous man is deemed one who regardeth the life of his beast. In stark contrast, the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. Proverbs 12:10. Human beings are therefore responsible, for better or worse, not only for their own individual integrity and the proper governance of the social world, but for the animals, domestic and wild alike, with whom they share the planet. This does not mean in any manner that animals have rights, as the existence of right is dependent on the capacity to reciprocate. But it certainly does mean that we are traditionally held to a high ethical standard in our relationship with other creatures, and that their very survival depends, as noted, on the wisdom even of our personal choices. The resurgence of dietary restrictions predicated on hypothetically moral grounds, the practice of vegetarianism foremost among them, is a consequence, at least in part, of that deep ethical necessity, misplaced and crippled though it certainly is, as a solution to the ultimate problem of proper moral conduct or even of proper stewardship. Although it is true that not that which goeth into the mouth defileth a man, but that which cometh out of the mouth, this defileth a man, Matthew 15:11. It is still and truly the case that the sacrifice of something living to ensure our continued survival is an act that should be consecrated to the highest possible purpose. Otherwise, conscience comes to call as it apparently has for a growing number of increasingly guilt-ridden consumers and second-rate sacrificers. It is clearly time in the modern world to confess our sins, repent, aim truly upward, tell the truth, and make the requisite difficult offerings. Instead, we insist on praying in public and using the name of God in vain, attributing to ourselves divine motivation when brandishing publicly our cards and gestures of protest and mouthing our hackneyed, self-aggrandizing, vegan, and more generally ideological slogans and cliches of envy and resentment. Teaching for doctrines the commandments of men, Matthew 15:9, is hypocrisy indeed. Therefore, and when thou prayest, thou shalt not be as the hypocrites are, for they love to pray, standing in the synagogues and in the corners of the streets, that they may be seen of men. Verily, I say unto you, they have their reward. But thou, when thou prayest, enter into thy closet, and when thou hast shut the door, pray to thy Father, which is in secret, and thy Father, which seeth in secret, shall reward thee openly. But when ye pray, use not vain repetitions, as the heathen do, for they think that they shall be heard for their much speaking. Be not ye therefore like unto them, for your Father knoweth what things ye have need of before ye ask him. There is no difference between the modern professional protesters brandishing their moral virtue like a club and the Pharisees who conspired to crucify Christ. That is all part of the eternal story. God, unhappy with the sinful state of the world, displeased by the blind and willful turning away of his should-be sons, commands Noah, the man wise in his generations, to build a giant boat and to place within it thou and thy sons and thy wife and thy sons' wives with thee, and of every living thing of all flesh, two of every sort shalt thou bring into the ark, to keep them alive with thee. They shall be male and female, of fowls after their kind, and of cattle after their kind, of every creeping thing of the earth after his kind. Two of every sort shall come unto thee to keep them alive. Genesis 6:29-31. For 40 days and 40 nights the deluge comes, pouring rain and rising waters, and everything upon the surface of the earth is washed away. And the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered. 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered, and all flesh died that moved upon the earth, both of fowl and of cattle and of beast and of every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth, and every man. Genesis 7:20-22. Thus Noah, the wise man who hearkens to the cautionary voice of God, builds the ark that eternally guides himself, his family, his community, and even the natural order itself through the storms. The promised and prophesied storms last the prototypical 40 days and nights, but the waters remain high for 4 times that length of time. Finally, however, the divine anger is quenched, the mountaintops reappear, and the new covenant is established. In the aftermath of this reemergence of the world from the watery chaos, God repeats to Noah the injunction given to Adam, Genesis 1:28, be fruitful and multiply upon the earth. Genesis 8:17, Genesis 9:1. In response, Noah initiates the habitation of this new cosmos with an approved sacrifice, Genesis 8:20, repeating the proper actions of Abel and forswearing the temptations of Cain. This means that the first prophet reconsecrates the world to God, establishing the upward aim as paramount, in contrast to the disorientation, confusion, self-serving hedonism, and mad power striving that characterized the descendants of the fratricidal, arrogant, and resentful brother. As a result, God swears to forego such total vengeance in the future. And the Lord smelled a sweet savor, and the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground any more for man's sake. For the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I again smite any more everything living as I have done. Well, the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. Genesis 8:21 to 22. In this manner, and now, and in the future, the honest sacrifice of the wise and good man is what forever forestalls the apocalypse. This is equally true at the personal and social levels. Equally true, it matters both micro and macrocosmic in scope. God also takes this occasion to remind human beings of their immense responsibility as stewards of this new and renewed garden, in parallel with the abundance simultaneously offered. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every fowl of the air, upon all that moveth upon the earth and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered. Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you. Even as the green herb have I given you all things. Genesis 9:2-3. The very essence of life itself, however, is to be reserved for God and not transgressed upon. But flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall ye not eat. Genesis 9:4. This appears to mean something like maintenance of proper respect for the gift or even existence of life, the soul of life itself. While man is permitted to have the body for his food, as being the mere vessel which contains this life, the gift itself must go back to God, and the blood as its symbol be treated with reverence. Ellicott's commentary for Christian readers. This appears to be a repetition of the injunction not to transgress against or to go too far, a forbidding reminiscent of and analogous to the prohibition against devouring the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, a reminder that there is something that should remain sacred even in the midst of all attempts to satiate. This limitation is driven home by accompanying limitations. Killing for food, assuming the proper sacrificial attitude, is morally permitted, but the killing that is careless or murderous is to be distinguished and forbidden. The New Living Translation puts it this way, and I will require the blood of anyone who takes another person's life. If a wild animal kills a person, it must die. And anyone who murders a fellow human must die. If anyone takes a human life, that person's life will also be taken by human hands, for God made human beings in his own image. Genesis 9:5-6. Arguably, this also establishes the preconditions for just war. Only the conflicts that are truly motivated by the attempt to maintain the self-sacrificial covenant with the divine are justified. Separating this from the doctrine of ends justify the means is no easy matter. But the fact of this difficulty should not come as a surprise. There is virtually nothing that presents a greater challenge than getting the moral house in order, particularly in the case of armed group conflict. The nature of the new covenant is also further clarified. Then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, "And I, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your seed after you, and with every living creature that is with you, of the fowl, of the cattle, and of every beast of the earth with you, from all that go out of the ark to every beast of the earth. And I will establish my covenant with you. Neither shall all flesh be cut off any more by the waters of a flood, neither shall there any more be a flood to destroy the earth." Genesis 9:8-11. At the end of all this, God, feeling well pleased with Noah and his sacrifice, famously hangs the rainbow in the sky. This is the perennial symbol that the storms have cleared and a sign of the permanence of this new agreement. And God said, "This is the token of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I do set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a token of a covenant between me and the earth. And it shall come to pass, when I bring a cloud over the earth, that the bow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And the waters shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh." Genesis 9:12-15. The rainbow is the full spectrum implicit in the transcendent and heavenly unity of the white light of the sun. It represents the ideally subdued community, which is the integration of the diversity of those who compose it into the singular harmony of present, balanced with future, and the individual, balanced with society. Also, it is simultaneously the interplay of the heavenly, that very sunlight that is offered from above, with the water that is also chaos, the tohu vabohu, or teom, and the source of the potential from which the world emerges. It is the balance between order, or the principle of order, the possibility of illumination or enlightenment itself, with the natural world, signifying the seamless integration of divine will with material world. The rainbow is, in all these manners, a complex and highly appropriate symbol of the newly renewed covenant. 4.4. The faithless son, doomed to enslavement. The story of Noah now takes a surprising turn. After departing from the ark, Noah and his sons and daughters immediately get to work, reflected and echoed in the fact of Noah's sacrifices. Noah, who is a man of the soil, Genesis 9:20, plants a vineyard, brews some wine, and somewhat carelessly over-imbibes, although, to be sure, he has just been through an awful lot. He ends up splayed out, naked, inside the private confines of his tent in the aftermath of this too intense celebration. One of his sons, Ham, takes the opportunity to treat his father with some contempt in his moment of vulnerability and weakness. He passes by Noah's tent with its flap open and observes his unclothed state. That is already a breach, not least of privacy. But Ham immediately compounds his error. He takes a jealous and arrogant delight in the revelation of his great father's all-too-human imperfection, as evidenced in the gossiping and narcissistic reputation savaging that he attempts to embark on with his brothers. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren without. Genesis 9:22. What Ham saw is described with the Hebrew word heira, according to the pulpit commentary. signifying to make naked, from a kindred root to which comes the term expressive of the nakedness of Adam and Eve after eating the forbidden fruit, Genesis 3:7. The sin of Ham, not a trifling and unintentional transgression, von Bohlen, obviously lay not in seeing what perhaps he may have come upon unexpectedly, but one in wickedly rejoicing in what he saw, which, considering who he was that was overcome with wine, the minister of salvation to men and the chief restorer of the world, the relation in which he stood to Ham, that of father, the advanced age to which he had now come, and the comparatively mature years of Ham himself, who was already more than 100 years old, should have filled him with sincere sorrow. But a son would have never have laughed at a father conquered by wine unless he had first expelled from his mind that reverence and respect that, according to God's command, children ought to have for their parents, Luther. And two, in reporting it, doubtless with a malicious purpose, to his brethren, and told his two brethren without, possibly inviting them to come and look upon their father's shame. It is for such reasons that Ham is regarded by tradition as the progenitor of the Canaanites, the descendants of Cain, to say it again, characterized in the biblical corpus as the eternally idolatrous and morally corrupt people, and the people over whom and over whose territory God therefore grants the Israelites dominion. This narrative subplot and characterization drives home a very harsh lesson. Children, descendants, physical and spiritual, of those who lack all respect for their parents, will be ruled over both inevitably and justly by the offspring of those who properly honor and revere their mothers and fathers, ancestors, and traditions. It is easy enough for conceptually addled moderns to confuse this warning with something like arbitrary prejudice against the Canaanites, with such prejudice also construed in the modern sense. This says nothing or very little about the ancient Israelites, however, and much instead about the ideological disruption of the modern mind. The idea that contempt for tradition, parental and otherwise, will be met with severe punishment harkens back once again to the Enuma Elish, the story of the original Mesopotamian gods, against whom the great female dragon of chaos, Tiamat, marshals her terrible forces. It is those first children, the fractious spirits, it might be said, of first-order instinct itself, who carelessly and arrogantly slay Apsu, the spirit of habitable order, and who then attempt to live both ungratefully and unproductively on the resultant corpse. This regicide, this parasitic inversion of social structure, this contempt for ancestral sacrifice, results in the visitation of a dreadful punishment on the wayward progeny of Tiamat. All the horrors of existence array themselves against them in the form of every imaginable demon and monster. This is certainly the metaphoric equivalent of a flood. To look with contempt on the nakedness or vulnerability of your father is simultaneously to tempt out of the abyss the eternal dragon of chaos and the vengeful wrath of God. Ingratitude veers perilously close in this manner to the cardinal and overweening sin of Luciferian pride. Ham's brothers righteously and wisely refuse to join in the mockery, choosing instead to extend an appropriate respect to the tradition that has just shepherded them through the cataclysm, and to do so even in a moment when the vulnerability and proclivity for error of the bearer of that tradition has revealed itself in the starkest and most basic manner possible. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned backward, and they did not see their father's nakedness. Genesis 9:23. It is a great error to judge someone, worse, to hold them in contempt solely on their behavior at their weakest moments. Every single person, dead or alive, judged in that manner would end up damned. Further, all gratitude for the gifts bequeathed upon us by those who lived in the past would vanish. That necessary gratitude, necessary to keep the productive spirit of the past alive, would be carelessly replaced instead by a thoroughly undeserved and narcissistic attitude of comparative virtue. We, in the modern world, are above all that. Thus, proclaim the desecrators of statues and monuments, and increasingly, great works of art. That careless dismissal and arrogant presumptuousness is tantamount, to say it again, to the killing of Apsu undertaken by the careless elder gods of the long-vanished Mesopotamian world, the hell that broke loose then, according to the ancient mythological account, threatens no less now in the immediate aftermath of Ham's betrayal. The fact that Ham reacts one way to the evidence of his father's imperfection and Shem and Japheth another has long-term and determinative significance. And Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done unto him. And he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." And he said, "Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant." Genesis 9:24-26. It is impossible for anyone who holds his tradition in contempt and arrogates to himself an unearned comparative moral version of it to simultaneously embody that tradition, let alone its best. To the degree that such embodiment is necessary in relationship to present or future success, and it is necessary to the degree that tradition has genuinely brought forward the proper spirit and practice of comprehensive adaptation, failure to make it manifest will produce comparative failure. Thus, the spiritual heirs of Noah's faithless son, Ham, who is characterized by careless contempt for the perceived weakness of his father, will always and inevitably end up in second place, or worse, as the veritable servants of, or even enslaved by, those who hold the proper attitude, not least concerning proper filial respect. It is not as if Shem and Japheth are naive either in their attitude and actions toward their father. They accept the fact that he has a fallen aspect, but make their respect known regardless. This is something approximating their capacity to appropriately separate wheat from chaff, as in Matthew 3:12, something akin to establishing a wise and responsible filial relationship to the spirit of the father and the past. Everything past does not have to be brought forward. Some appreciation for the faults of the paternal can be developed in the course of the maturation of the son, but a fundamental attitude of reverence must be maintained. This is something for us all to relearn in these days of hypocritical and prideful apology for the sins of the past, both real and imaginary. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Exodus 20:12. Noah lives long in exactly that manner, and implicitly for that reason, although such a destiny also properly befits a man of renown. And Noah lived after the flood 350 years, and all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Genesis 9:28-29. His example, like that of Abraham, the next great prophet, establishes the pattern of proper being for those who abide by the Spirit of God, manifested not least through the Father, wise in his generations. This is the pattern characteristic of the descendants of Shem, such as Abraham, and of Japheth, the true heirs of Seth, and the proper spirit of sacrifice, reverence, and worship, who spread across the lands. By these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, every one after his tongue, after their families, in their nations. Genesis 10:5. Variant alternate translations insist upon the maritime prowess of these descendants, for example, stressing in this manner their adaptability, their tendency to disseminate effectively. Their descendants became the seafaring peoples that spread out to various lands, each identified by its own language, clan, and national identity. New International Version. From these, the people of the coastlands of the nations were separated and spread into their lands, everyone according to his own language, according to their constituent groups, families, and into their nations. Amplified Bible. Well, the children of Ham are held to be those who occupy the second place. This is all to drive home the point that the pattern of success that characterizes the faithful, upward-aiming, and courageous children of Seth must be predicated on respect both for tradition in its human form and for the Spirit or Word whose manifestation has eternally given rise to that tradition. Chapter 5, The Tower of Babel, God versus Tyranny and Pride. 5.1, Lucifer and the Engineers. The Bible's first builders of cities, fabricators of musical instruments and weapons of war, the individuals who pursue technological solutions, are significantly the children of Cain. We read this directly in the text, and it is true thematically, insofar as the pursuit of technology engaged in by these builders constitutes both a substitute for proper ethical striving and a form of worship of the intellect. They are the engineers, builders, and inhabitants of the eternal Babylon, the city of the prideful and presumptuous. Some of the largest buildings first built by people when establishing the first cities took the architectural form of the ziggurat, a stepped pyramid. Ziggurats were common in the ancient Near East, but also appeared elsewhere, most notably in Central America. A ziggurat reaches to the sky, step by step, in a fashion clearly reminiscent of a hierarchy. In fact, ziggurat-like or pyramidal forms are often employed in the modern world by graphic designers who wish to display a relationship of hierarchical dependency. Ziggurats had their practical functions, serving as places of sacrifice or other sacred rituals, often associated with the temple complexes central to ancient cities and housing various economic and administrative operations. However, they were primarily monuments to the grandeur or grandiosity of a given ruler, or in a more generous interpretation, his society. The higher the ziggurat, the grander the potentate, and by inference, the more intimidating the polity. The Egyptians devoted tremendous resources to the construction of their pyramids, similar in design and purpose to the ziggurats, in the similar attempt to elevate the status of their pharaohs to near godly levels, to the degree that the pyramidal form was a pan to the idea of divine hierarchy, with the gold cap representing the attending eye that sits atop any properly arranged hierarchical symbolic form, their soaring creations were perhaps justified in a deeper and non-egoistic sense. Considered in that light, The pyramids are an early architectural expression of striving toward God, seen again millennia later in the great cathedrals of the late Middle Ages and later Renaissance. Eliade comments on architecture as bridge to the heavens. As for the assimilation of temples to cosmic mountains and their function as links between earth and heaven, the names given to Babylonian sanctuaries themselves bear witness. They are called Mountain of the House, House of the Mountain of All Lands, Mountain of Storms, Link between Heaven and Earth, and the like. The ziggurat was literally a cosmic mountain. The seven stories represented the seven planetary heavens. By ascending them, the priest reached the summit of the universe. But it was also in Babylon that the connection